Thank you for inviting me, and it's a pleasure to be here. What I'm going to do tonight is recapitulate some of the arguments that I've already actually made in print in the first foray in my work on tolerance, which was published in a German volume on tolerance last year. And so tonight I'll be rehearsing some of the arguments that appear in that essay in order to give you a general picture of what I'm doing. On Wednesday, I'll be taking up a particular question, which is the question of why, in the 19th century in Europe, tolerance was the rubric under which the Jewish question was often considered, but equality was the rubric under which the question of woman was considered. And I'll be posing the question, why? Why does one form of emancipation emerge as a question of tolerance while the other emerges as a question of equality? And on Thursday, I'll be looking more specifically at tolerance as a practice of what Foucault called governmentality, a practice which is, I will argue, a state practice, but not one which necessarily emanates from the state. A practice which is taken up in civil society, a practice which circulates through discourse, a practice which nonetheless both serves to legitimate the state and also, I will be arguing at the most severe moment in my argument, a practice which enables certain kinds of state violence. So that's the picture. Let me tell you tonight then, in general, what kinds of provocations tolerance has produced for me. This project probes the anti-democratic dimensions of contemporary tolerance discourse. It queries what appears at first blush as an unquestionable good, that is, it's good to be tolerant. And it queries what appears to be an unquestionable good in order to attempt to discern the anti-democratic effects of tolerance practices, which include, I shall argue, certain attenuations of citizenship, the substitution of political claims by natural and cultural claims, certain retreats from egalitarianism as a vision and a practice, the expansion of state power, the reduction of citizen power, the intensification of disciplinary regulation, and the privatization or depoliticization of common concerns. So that, in a set of phrases, are the quarrels I shall be presenting as my quarrels with tolerance discourse. I won't be arguing that the invocation of tolerance today always occasions all of these things. Rather, what I will do is consider the ways that the very complex and protean discourse of tolerance can function as part of what Foucault called a governmentality that has these effects. My interest in the problem of tolerance actually arose from several sources, some worldly, some academic. I'll start at the academic end. Several years ago, a German colleague of mine was putting together a volume in political theory on tolerance, and he invited me to engage that old essay of Herbert Marcuse's, the 1965 essay Repressive Tolerance. He had a hunch that there was a link between the argument of that essay and my own research on disciplinary power and the problems of freedom. So I took up the challenge and I reread Marcuse's essay for the first time in 20 years. When I was a student, we all read it often as something of a manifesto. And what I was surprised to find when I reread it is that it was actually deeply disappointing. It's often what happens when you revisit as elements of your student days, I think. The most persuasive elements of the essay actually struck me now as relatively commonsensical and as commonsensical for the culture as a whole, even sort of generally moderate liberal circles. And what I have in mind here is that Marcuse argues that tolerance can function as a practice of domination rather than freedom, and that it can delude us into believing that we're free and making free choices when we actually are not. His argument goes this way. If conditions of thinking, speaking, and choosing are not free, but are rather, to use his language, administered, then our exercise of these functions actually may serve to legitimate the status quo. He also argues that tolerance, which he says was coined originally as an emancipatory doctrine, today often amounts to passivity toward domination and toward what he calls radical evil. Now, these polemical claims seem true in part, if rather lacking in nuance, but they also no longer seem novel, and that's a measure, perhaps, of the extent to which certain Frankfurt School critiques of liberalism have been absorbed into mainstream liberal thought. Moreover, the notion that tolerance was ever purely in the service of emancipation, even in the Renaissance and the Reformation, the idea that once upon a time it was not a regulatory or state legitimating practice, struck me as naive and empirically false. But there are other elements of Marcuse's essay that really seemed utterly without viability in the current episteme. Marcuse argues that to recuperate the liberatory dimension of tolerance doctrine, tolerance must be practiced for the sake of what he calls truth. And he says it ceases to serve that function when it's pursued by administered or indoctrinated subjects as opposed to the ones he imagines that used to exist, namely free-thinking, autonomous subjects. More generally, he argues, the classic equation of tolerance, truth, and freedom requires that individuals be capable of deliberating and choosing on what he calls the basis of authentic information and autonomous thought, a condition, again, that he implies once held, but in the condition of capitalism that he's analyzing in the mid part of the 20th century, no longer holds. Most famously, he argues that restoring tolerance to an emancipatory practice requires a refusal to tolerate certain statements and doctrines. And he argues that what should and should not be tolerated can be rationally indexed according to whether a particular utterance either abets or forestalls progress. And progress for him is simply defined as whatever helps the world and world history along toward emancipation. So any utterance, any discourse, any practice that objectively in his mind creates a drag on progress should not be tolerated. Now, these kinds of claims, their reliance upon an absolutely unreconstructed Enlightenment supposition about truth, objectivity, progress, freedom of thought, and their unification with one another, these kinds of statements barely seem utterable, let alone tenable today. The figure of the autonomous, freely willing, deliberating subject strikes me as fantastic as the notion that there's a rational and objective calculus by which emancipatory and regressive utterances can be measured. So my enthusiasm for Marcuse's arguments was thin. My encounter with my past was a bit dreary, but I remained intrigued and compelled by his impulse, namely the impulse to subject tolerance to critical scrutiny from a left perspective. And I was particularly intrigued by this impulse in the context of the current resurgence of tolerance doctrine today. The use of tolerance to frame everything from conflict in the Middle East and conflict in Rwanda and the former Soviet bloc to episodes of racialized or homophobic violence in the United States. Indeed, as I shall argue, as the language of tolerance has been absorbed by multicultural discourse today, it has been expanded from its traditional concern with protecting differing beliefs, especially in the domain of religion, to an articulation of the telos, the very purpose, the end of multicultural citizenship. In other words, in contemporary popular usage, tolerance refers to an ethos and practice of coexisting with people of various races, ethnicities, cultures, and sexual practices. Tolerance, in short, has become a generalized language of anti-prejudice. And here I simply want to offer three examples from the American context. There is in the United States an organization called Teaching Tolerance. It's a project of a larger group called the Southern Poverty Law Center, and it's a nonprofit foundation that hails from the American Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s. Now, Teaching Tolerance literature and educational materials span a wide range of conflicts, prejudice, violence, and suffering, ranging from concerns with displaced Palestinians to migrant workers, to children with chronic medical conditions, to Native Americans. As I read through this material, my questions continued, when I began this project, and continue to be, what's the significance of gathering such diverse causes under the sign of tolerance? What kind of political or ethical goal is tolerance? What kind of analytic frame is tolerance and intolerance? And, remembering that the name of the organization is Teaching Tolerance, in what sense is tolerance something that must or can be taught? What does it mean to treat it as something that must be taught, as it were, that is not native or natural to human beings? Second example of the ubiquitousness of tolerance discourse today and the way in which it has shifted from a discourse concerned with protecting belief and conscience to concern with various kinds of injury, violence, and subjugated identity. Most American schools today claim to promote tolerance as the basis for producing multicultural communities of learning. They claim to promote tolerance as a way of developing appropriate attitudes toward difference for the next generation of citizens. And as I considered the ways in which American schools use the language of tolerance to inculcate children in a certain notion of community and appropriate treatment of one another, I wondered again what this language is teaching young people about race and ethnicity. That is, what are young people learning about race and ethnicity through the language or discourse of tolerance? What are older students learning about the norms organizing sexual desire as they learn about tolerating different sexualities? What managed diffidence or aversion to an imagined other does the language of tolerance incite or orchestrate? What kind of shroud might this language wrap around histories of racial inequality, colonial domination, heterosexual exclusions, or violence? A third instance of the ubiquitousness of tolerance discourse today in multicultural discourse also comes from the American site. There is a museum of tolerance in Los Angeles, and this museum is dedicated to depicting two historical instances of intolerance: Jewish suffering in the Holocaust, and the experience of African Americans through most of the history of the United States, but especially concentrating on the period of slavery. In a couple of exhibits, there are a few other historical events and issues that are also dealt with: Bosnia, Rwanda, the Roma in Europe, homophobic hate crime in the United States, but the really deliberate and explicit concentration of the museum is on these two episodes of what the museum calls intolerance, the Shoah and slavery in the United States. So the question here is, what does it mean to identify these two historical formations, slavery in the 18th and 19th century in the United States, the Holocaust in the 20th century in Europe? What does it mean to identify these two historical formations as instances of intolerance, and also to treat them as commensurate with each other in some way? How does this invocation of tolerance expand the traditional purview of tolerance from matters of religious belief, matters of conscience, to matters of cultural and racial identity? How does it change the rubric of tolerance from a concern with ideas to a concern with persons? And what are the consequences of this expanded purview? What potentially disturbing conflation of belief, phenotype, and cultural practices is the discourse of tolerance itself producing? What xenophobia might it be naturalizing? What, too, to make of the way the museum incarnates the migration of tolerance from an express term of compromise among incompatible beliefs or practices to something that is meant to connote much more positive versions of cultural cohabitation? So I begin here with a set of worries about contemporary tolerance discourse as, and I'll put it boldly now, an impoverished and impoverishing framework through which domestic, civil, and international conflicts and events were being formulated, through which identity was being understood and produced, and through which difference was being theorized and negotiated. But in addition to my general concern with what I saw as the ubiquitousness and in some ways the unthinking quality of contemporary tolerance discourse, I was also impelled in this work by a set of what I can only call generic anxieties about tolerance. Obviously, it's always better to be tolerated than not, if those are the choices. But the experience of being tolerated is inevitably one of being condescended to, of being forborne. Whether it's, "I can't tolerate that noise," as the response of the older generation to the music cherished by contemporary youth, or, "We've become more tolerant now, and we now allow Jews and homosexuals to join our fraternity." Tolerance always appears to express the extent to which the existence, the behavior, the ancestry, or the attachments of one group are permitted or forbidden at the behest of another group. The object of tolerance is constructed as marginal, inferior, other, outside the community, in some relation of enmity with the community. Moreover, tolerance would appear always to articulate and conserve a certain norm. The articulation occurs through whatever occasions tolerance, and the conservation of the norm is achieved through the act of tolerance. Both the marginalizing and the normativizing aspects of tolerance emerge very clearly in the various edicts of tolerance in early modern Europe, such as those concerned with Protestants in France and Hungary, Jews in Prussia and Austria. Through the Austrian Edict of Tolerance in 1783, for example, Jews, of course, were no longer required to wear yellow stars outside the ghetto. They acquired rights to go to public schools, entertainment. They were allowed to enter trades and organize factories, but they could not join guilds. They could not become masters in their own crafts. They could not own land outside the ghetto. They had no civic rights, could not engage in public worship without it being regulated, and were not allowed to increase their population. In short, the tolerated under this particular edict were to remain a separate and second class of citizens. As long as they abided by these limitations and rules, their difference would be forborne. But the point is not simply that the edicts merely subordinated while pretending to emancipate Jews. They also reaffirmed the Christian nature of the culture and the state, the Christian premises of political citizenship and economic standing. So what's tolerated also reaffirmed, that is, conserved the norm of the naturalness, the power, and the authority of those who were doing the tolerating. The particulars of the edicts established what the tolerant could handle or absorb without threatening or eroding that power and authority. Thus, it would appear that tolerance by nature cannot be absolute, else it ceases to be tolerance. Tolerance is inherently freighted with rules, limits, and conditions, as well as with normative purposes that exceed generosity or embrace. It's possible to see what I'm calling these constraining and normative forces at work in a more contemporary example, what's come to be called in the United States the don't ask, don't tell policy of the U.S. military toward homosexuals. Now, this policy is riddled with complexities of interpretation and comportment, but at its most basic, the policy allows homosexuals to enlist and remain in the military, provided that they do not publicly avow or enact their desire. They don't speak their desire, and they don't enact it. Thus, this policy, don't ask, don't tell, is simultaneously a policy of tolerance that establishes that homosexuals will be permitted employment in the military if they live furtively and dishonestly. It's also a policy that discursively shores up heterosexuality as the norm of military sociality and sexuality. I want to pause here and reflect more generally on the term tolerance. The Oxford English Dictionary, after noting the Latin root of tolerance, tolerare, meaning to bear, to endure, to put up with, and always implying a certain moral disapproval, the OED offers three accounts of tolerance as an ethical or political term. First, tolerance is the action or practice of enduring pain or hardship. Second, tolerance is the action of allowing. It's license, permission granted by an authority. And third, the OED tells us, tolerance is the disposition to be patient with or indulgent toward the opinions or practices of others. It is freedom from bigotry in judging the conduct of others. It's forbearance. It's Catholicity of spirit. Now, from these three definitions, enduring, licensing, and indulging, we can deduce that tolerance entails suffering something someone would rather not suffer, but being positioned socially such that you can determine whether or how to suffer it, what you will allow from it. Both normative power and authority, therefore, are presuppositions of tolerance. Indeed, it makes very little sense to speak of a subordinate tolerating those who rule or dominate. It's this position, power, and authority that make possible that third dimension of tolerance I just listed, a posture of indulgence toward what one permits or license. But it's that posture, it's the indulgence, the patience that tolerance presumes, that softens or cloaks the power and the authority and the normativity in an act of tolerance. So tolerance would appear then as an act of power that inherently entails this softening disguise, this catholicity of spirit. Magnanimity appears as a luxury of power, but in the case of tolerance, it also disguises power. Now, what the OED definitions together identify is that a tolerant posture is neither a neutral nor a respectful one. Rather, tolerance checks an attitude or condition of enmity, disdain, or contempt with a peculiar kind of overcoming. An overcoming that's enabled by a certain strength, perhaps domination, perhaps cultural capital, perhaps other kinds of capital, a kind of domination that's enabled either by the fortitude to throw off the danger or the capaciousness to incorporate or license its existence. So toleration indeed appears to carry within it the domination, the permanent antagonism toward alterity, as well as the capacity for normalization that I suggested was in it on an intuitive level. Developed into a doctrine and social practice in modernity, more recently extended toward all manner of cultural identities, tolerance appears to be part of the formation Foucault named biopower, a peculiarly modern form of power that involves the subjugation of bodies and the control of populations through the regulation of life rather than the threat of death. Now, this dimension of tolerance appears all the more vividly if you leave generic dictionary definitions for a moment to consider the way the term's used in all kinds of technical fields. In plant physiology, drought tolerance, or shade tolerance, refers to the amount of deprivation that a fundamental substance, water or sun, that a plant can bear and still survive. In medicine, tolerance of drugs, tolerance of implanted organs, refers to a combination of handling what's foreign or strange to the body and of enduring what is patently toxic to the body. In human physiology more generally, the concept of alcohol tolerance or histamine tolerance refers to the body's capacity to absorb or metabolize what's alien or threatening to it. Statistical tolerances identify the margin of error that can be sustained by statistical truths without nullifying or falsifying them. And in engineering, mechanics, and minting, tolerance refers to the acceptable distances, the mismeasures or degrees of deviation that can be allowed, the gaps and flaws that can be borne without creating structural weaknesses or invalidation. What do all these different meanings suggest together? In every lexicon, I'm suggesting, tolerance signifies the limits on what foreign, erroneous, objectionable, or dangerous element can be allowed to cohabit with the host without destroying the host, whether the entity at issue is truth, structural soundness, health, community, or the survival of an organism. The very invocation of tolerance in each domain indicates that something dangerous or damaging is at hand, something foreign is at issue, and the limits of tolerance are judged by how much of this damage, how much of this foreignness can be accommodated without destroying the object, the value, the claim, or the body. Tolerance, in short, is always a form of protecting the host through the setting of limits and conditions on the variations that the host can harbor. Put another way, tolerance, or in sort of Nietzschean fashion, tolerance always signals something of a digestion problem, the need for a practice of management or limits on an undigestible element in what is imagined to be otherwise a homogeneous or at least structurally sound entity. Now, this suggests that the incorporation of tolerance into contemporary multiculturalist discourse reveals that discourse as figuring something other than a happy community of differences. It suggests, too, that we would do well to understand both the norm and the antagonist at stake in this contemporary conception of community, to see what's valued, what's considered threatening to that value, to see what relations of enmity and permanent alterity are imagined, and to see how these relations are to be handled. Before moving to that consideration, though, I want to complete this brief tour of the various meanings and valences of tolerance by turning to its specifically political meaning. Tolerance in modern political and religious thought, of course, has a very distinctive genealogy. It's usually considered to be inaugurated with the Renaissance Humanist Council of Toleration of Heretics in the 15th and 16th centuries. The humanists, in short, advocated tolerance in what was notably an intolerant period in order to try to get acceptance of those who were suspected of religious heresy by granting them full membership in the church, at the same time acknowledging their deviation from certain church principles. The idea was religious dissenters who disagree about non-essentials, while accepting the fundamentals of faith, should be allowed their minor disagreements and remain within the church. In the late 17th century in England, this type of toleration was termed comprehension because it sought to include or comprehend nonconformists within the church. And comprehension is distinguished from tolerance insofar as comprehension applies to denominations that were inside the church, and then tolerance was used later to talk about outside denominations. The early humanists, though, would not have embraced such a distinction. They didn't recognize yet, of course, what was going to be the permanent fragmentation of Christian unity. But of course, it's not the Renaissance, it's the Reformation that contains for most of us the development of tolerance doctrine that we recognize as its origins for liberalism. Concern with tolerance in the Reformation, which features a proliferation of religious sects, a widespread struggle against the hegemony of the Anglican Church, is most famously codified by John Locke's letter concerning toleration. Written at the behest of the Earl of Shaftesbury during the exclusion crisis, published anonymously in 1689, Locke's aim in the letter is to sharply distinguish civil from religious life. He jumbles heaven and earth together, things most remote and opposite, who mixes these two societies, Locke polemicizes, and then proceeds to specify the opposition of civil from religious spheres of activity. Religion is for the achievement of an afterlife, and heaven concerns the salvation of souls. Political society is for the organization of this life on earth and concerns worldly goods. Locke specifies these goods: life, liberty, health, indolency of body, and possession of outward things, money, land, houses, furniture, public justice, equity, etc., he says. Now, this sharp attenuation of the bearing of religion on everyday civil and political life allows Locke, in the same gesture, to privatize religious belief, to render it an individual and private, rather than public and common matter. The care of every man's soul belongs to himself, Locke declares, signaling the emergence of an intensely individualistic and privatistic believer, one who will become the signature, or at least the stick figure, of modernity. Now, clearly, one effect of privatizing religious belief is to reduce its truth claim, inevitably imbuing religious belief with the quality of subjective belief, the ones that indeed undergird ordinances of religious tolerance today. So Locke's formulation indicates the beginning of a paradox of modern tolerance doctrine. That which is most vital to individuals qua individuals, personal belief or conscience, is not only what's divorced from public life, but it is divorced from the standing of truth. Tolerance of diverse beliefs in a community becomes possible to the extent that those beliefs are phrased as having no public importance, as being constitutive of a private individual whose private beliefs and commitments have minimal bearing on the structure and pursuits of political and social life, and as having no reference to a settled authority about truth. So two things are simultaneously achieved by this privatization, individualization, and subjectivization of religious belief and of moral and ethical values more generally. On the one hand, civil and political power are rendered technical, material, juridical, practical. They're divested of moral, religious, or spiritual meaning and grounding. On the other hand, religion and all matters of conscience are rendered private and individual. They're divested of political or communal bearing, thus making the notion of a political ethics something of an oxymoron. Moreover, community and political life itself has to be radically reduced. It cannot have a thick fabric to it without invoking the very belief structures that must be limited and private if they are not to be mandated by authority and not to be underscored by truth with a capital T. Religious and ethical life must stay sharply bounded, minimizing their claims on community or public ways of life. Now, Locke's proposed radical compromise of the claims and place of religious and ethical truth, of conscience and belief, hardly coincided with either the dominant or minority sects of the age. Locke was offering a strategy for peace that satisfied almost no one at the time, given passionate investments in religious orthodoxy and absolutism, given deep convictions about the exhaustive reach of religion. So tolerance is initially proffered and embraced not as a moral or principled conviction, but as a practical solution to an impossible impasse, a fact that I think is too rarely recalled about another moment in the genealogy of modern tolerance doctrine, namely the American founding. It's commonplace to frame the founding of the United States as coterminous with the embrace of tolerance. As they fled from an intolerant religious and political culture in the Old World, the Puritans, as they arrive on the New England shores, are credited with establishing a new order founded upon tolerance. But it's important to remember that the settler colonialists of New England comprised highly orthodox religious communities, most of them devoted to pursuing and policing religious and moral truths as fiercely as any cult might today. Hence, while tolerance of first, conflicting religious practices, and then later dissident ideas or speech, are certainly at the heart of the political tradition of tolerance in the United States, this heart is not without its own paradox. Tolerance is a principle coined of necessity, a necessity produced by a collision of absolutist principles, and in this sense is something of an anti-principle. Bluntly, in the New World, tolerating other zealots was required so that one's own zealotry would be tolerated, and there were, of course, all kinds of limits to tolerance in the founding period. Moreover, tolerance was importantly an intercommunal principle rather than an intracommunal one, as the haunting figure of Hawthorne's Hester Prynne affirms. Now, recognition of the absolutist and authoritarian strains in the ostensibly tolerant New World suggests yet another tension at the heart of the American tradition of tolerance, one phrased in the present by Will Kimlicka's distinction between what he calls a liberal model of tolerance based on individual liberty and what he calls a hypercommunitarian model based on group rights. Kimlicka associates this second model, the hyper-communitarian group rights model, with the Ottoman Empire millet system, in which Jewish and Christian communities were permitted both religious freedom and a fair degree of political self-governance by the Muslim Turks. However, tolerance among diverse religious communities in early America may be as important an ingredient of the American tolerance tradition as individual freedom of speech and conscience, although the former, that is, the notion of diverse religious communities as the basis of American tolerance tradition, I think lives a somewhat repressed existence in contemporary tolerance discourse, and we'll come back to the significance of that repression in a moment. The importance of this repressed strain of tolerance tradition will be examined shortly. At this point, I simply want to summarize the several tensions in tolerance doctrine that emerge from this extremely partial survey of its political genealogy and modernity. First, depositing meaning at the individual, private, non-political level and divesting the state, the formal site of political community, of matters of collective belief inevitably produces and effectively overbuilds local sites of truth. In other words, the formulation that tolerance produces by privatizing ethical and religious belief, by making it a subjective, local, and individual matter, that formulation fosters local communities whose truths may be radically antagonistic toward one another. The more secular, technocratic, and bureaucratic the state becomes, the more powerful is this tendency to overbuild these local sites of truth and conviction, these sites that are officially non-political and must officially stay out of the orbit of politics. This tendency to overbuild these local sites of truth while rendering the state secular, technocratic, procedural, and bureaucratic, this tendency is expressed, of course, in those persistently difficult policy issues that the secular state tries to finesse. Suicide, abortion, homosexuality, capital punishment are some of the most highly articulated in contemporary American life. But this tendency is also expressed as a social formation of marked subjects. And what I mean here is that this overbuilding of local sites of truth contributes to a contemporary pressure on social life to organize according to local identities based on attributes such as ethnicity or sexuality or gender, and expressed through putatively differing belief structures or values that are thought to correspond to these attributes.